Accession number 9752, reel 2.
Colonel Dillon, Reel 2. You went, I think, on a sea cruise in 1914. I wonder if you could tell me a little about that.
Well, after I left school at Haileybury, my father got the opportunity of a free passage for me in a cargo ship which had a few passengers and which sailed around the Mediterranean. So I set off early in the year and did what used to be called years ago the Grand Tour. We first of all called at Port Said, where I had my first taste of the usual Egyptian touts on the quay side. From there I went up to Cairo, spent the night in the hotel on the Esbekir Square, which is very comfortable in French style, and the complete day I spent there cost me the equivalent of 7 and 6 months. I went round, did the traditional things, rode round the pyramids, and our next step, having seen what was to be seen in a quick time in Cairo, our next step was for the Holy Land.
What were your fellow passengers like? How many were there?
There were 6 or 8 passengers, an odd selection, rather elderly couples, and one alcoholic who's very troublesome, who'd been sent on this trip to get him out of the way, I think. It didn't stop him drinking. Can you stop it, will you? Yes. When I finished going around the Great Pyramid, I'm sure the guide pointed out to me a boat which was being excavated just near the entrance to the tomb. And I thought nothing about it until I was in Egypt again many years later on. And this was about 1936, I think, and nothing was known about this boat at all. Nobody had ever heard of it. But more recently still, I hear the boat has been excavated and it's all complete with its rowers and oars and everything, and has a house built over it as a great show piece. So what happened is an absolute mystery to me, whether I had a psychic vision of a boat or not, I do not know. The one thing I do know, and that is that Egypt affected me psychologically, or psychically, in the most extraordinary way, that I have an affinity with it and with the people who lived in the 3,000-5,000 years ago, which is most remarkable to me, and it comes back to me at odd moments. So I think I must have had a previous life or been in love with a girl who lived at Giza, and which is, keeps coming back to me in this life. I don't know.
You say you went on to the Holy Land then?
We then went on this merchant ship, you see, with a cargo ship, not a primary for passengers, so she just went where she picked up cargo. And we went on from picking up cargo at Portside, went on around to Haifa, where we were able to leave the ship and go up to Jerusalem, where I stayed a night in the King Stephen Hotel, which at that time was a small hotel just inside the, I think, the Jaffa Gate of the city. I did all the usual things in Jerusalem, saw the various places, went back to the ship. We then went on up to Beirut, and I had a surprising experience of coming up face to face with a sea lion while I was swimming in the harbour off the ship's side. No more excitements. I resisted the temptation to buy a lot of rubbish and bring it home. I was given, I think £10 to start with, and got another £10 sent to me, and that is all the money I had for the complete trip until we got back home at the end of February.
It's February
1914.
Did you go back to the mine then to see him?
I started there at the mine.
Oh, that's when you started.
I started after that. So I wasn't very long in the mines.
Can you tell me a little about what you did at Siam?
I started off going with the overman. And the overman is what you might call in other trades, we call a foreman. And he has an area underground, might be several square miles, tunnels leading into it from the pit bottom. And he'd be responsible for that district, as they called them. And he'd go round and watch the various workers hewing at their various places. In those days, they didn't have a continuous face worked by machinery, but they had little various faces where men are digging away, loading coal into little trucks, which are then pushed out to a central point or hauled by a pony out to a central point, and then they're hooked onto a great long cable which came from the pit head down to the bottom of the pit at bottom and out to the various places where these stations were. Then there were boys whose job it was to make up the trains. When the train was fully made up, the pit bottom was signalled and the winding engine started winding, and it wound the coal to the pit bottom. Thence it went by the lift or cage up to the top. That's the system. The places varied where the men were digging, where the coal was easy to get. It was called a good cable, a place where it's very hard, or very lot of stone in it, is known as the bad cable.
Which colliery had you been sent to work at?
This was Siam Colliery itself. I think it was sunk in 1830, something like that.
And this was your probationary?
Yes. That's my probationary time.
What were you supposed to be training as?
I was training eventually to become a mining engineer, and my progress would have been to, in due course, have finished going round with the overseers, and eventually being able to have a small district on my own, from then a larger area to supervise, and eventually sub-manager of a pit, a complete pit, and then the pit manager. And then one would go on, if you're clever enough, to supervise, not to supervise, to become an engineer who could advise other collieries as to troubles they were having, or sinking new pits. and so forth.
What sort of thing in this first 5 or 6 months was this? Was the overman trying to teach you, or what were you supposed to pick up from him?
Well, because very rough and ready, and they were trying to teach me what the conditions were underground, how various faults and rock falls were negotiated and dealt with and propped up, and most importantly, how the ventilation system worked. Part of our job was to go around the ventilation system and see that it was working, because it was a vital thing for the colliery. Should there be any gas, escape of gas, unless the ventilation system was good, you would have a disaster on your hands. And so the ventilation system went down the pit bottom and to the places where the men were working. Then the circulation was completed by passaging the used air off into old workings, which formed the return journey to the pit bottom, where it went up another shaft altogether. Now, the perambulation of these used workings was very hazardous, because they had not been, they were never very much well looked after, because they were going to be left to fall in anyway, and very often the timber had been pulled out for that reason. And so that it was pretty tricky. I have to this day a scar in the middle of my back where a half-ton rock fell on it. It difficultly managed to get from beneath it with the help of the overman. And then in the afternoon, that was probably, I might go down the pit in the morning, goodness knows, 4 in the morning, be up at roughly midday, have some food, and go to the office to look at the surveyor's charts and learn about surveying in the afternoon. It was a pretty full day. I didn't require any rocking when I got into bed.
Did you take to this career?
I can't say that I took to it very much. I realised I was in a very lucky position, because my father was chief agent to the Lord Londonderry at that time, and he had 3 colliery companies and a dock company, goodness knows what else under his thumb. I was in a very plum position to get a job. But I wasn't at all enamoured with what was going on. I was frankly mechanically minded. I wanted to deal with mechanical things, and not only mechanical things, to make things. I had an itch to use my fingers. And it all seemed very, the coal working, it all seemed very dirty and rough and smelly, and I mean smelt of coal tar, which was the canvas is used to direct the air where it had to go. The whole place was laden with the smell of coal dust and coal tar, and it was filthy from head to foot from the moment you began till you finished. And it wasn't really very satisfying to anybody with a mechanical bent.
How did you get on with the miners?
Oh, very well. A bit stuffy to start with, because I was the agent's son. I always had that hanging around my neck. But I didn't have much trouble. They were very well disciplined below ground. That's the odd thing. And above ground, the miners were undisciplined. I think rather unpleasant type, but down below he realizes the discipline is necessary for his existence. Therefore they're very well, toe the line very easily, and in fact they make discipline for themselves, because their lives depended on them.
So you were at CM learning the trade from February until August, I presume?
Yes, until August.
Did you see the war approaching? Had you any idea?
Everybody knew it was coming. Even when I was at school, we used to pay so much every term subscription towards Lord Roberts' appeal for, I think, conscription or something of that nature, compulsory service. Everybody knew it was coming, everybody, because the German attitude was staring him in the face, just as it was in the next war, World War. But of course, just as in the last one, so in the first one, everybody said, oh no, the Germans are nice people and nothing like that will ever happen. But I was glad I served in the OTC, although the amount of military training it gave one was practically negligible. At least one learned how to shoulder a slope of arms and fire a rifle, do elementary drill, that sort of thing. It was a background of some sort when I eventually stepped into the ranks, real part of the army.
Do you remember the day war broke out? Can you remember anything about it?
Nothing special, except general gloom all around my family.
Why was that? Because a lot of people we hear celebrated when war broke out. Your family were despondent?
Well, yes, you see, my mother had three sons and a daughter. Both my brothers were members of the RNVR, which is a sort of territorial navy, and I was an obvious starter for the army, and because she was naturally enough a little bit unhappy when it actually happened.
What did you feel about the war? Did you think you'd be in it? Were you, yourself? Were you?
I didn't think anything until I saw Lord Kitchener's letter, which occurred very early in the war.
What letter was this?
Saying, it's a famous picture saying, England needs you. It's a picture of Kitchener with a staring eye and a pointing finger. A very well-known picture.
That poster actually affected you, did it?
That poster, and in addition to which, the appeal for young men with OTC training, public school boys, to enlist, to offer themselves for commissions.
Now, was it a feeling of patriotism and duty that took you into the army, or did you see it as an escape from a career that you weren't apparently enjoying too much? Or was it a mixture of both, or what was it exactly?
No, I think it was a matter of duty. I talked it over with my father, and he said, I think you ought to go. And we put my own name down. Mind you, at that time, everybody felt it was only a demonstration against the Germans, and it would never really break out into fighting war with them, but that we should be getting ready, and the whole thing would cool off as it had done before. That was the attitude in people's minds. So I didn't do anything until I saw this notice that any potential officer should report to the Northumberland Fusiliers Barracks at Finham in Newcastle.
Do you know what date that was?
Which I did. It was very early, in August 1914. I think in the first 10 days.
So what happened when you reported at Fenham Barracks?
There I saw an elderly retired colonel who took down all my particulars, age, and where I'd been to school, and what training I'd had, and so forth.
Had you considered joining as a private, or?
No. Let me see. They asked particularly for public school boys, and so there's no point in joining as a private. They then dug one out and made one an officer in spite of that. There's no nonsense like they have nowadays, having to go through the ranks, etc., etc.
So he took your details. What sort of question did he ask you, this colonel?
Well, it was just the sort of things I said. Where were you educated? What did you do at school? Did you take part in the OTC manoeuvres? It's not standard of sportsmanship. Where did you come in the school teams? All those fairly obvious questions. I took down my name and address and said that I would hear later. And
so you went back home?
I went back home.
And when did you hear?
I heard about far as I remember, I heard about a fortnight later.
Do you remember the date of your commission?
Yes, it was the 22nd of September 1914. In fact, and odd coincidence, I got two commissions. So by some administrative error, so I presume if I had been court-martialed and expelled from the army, I could have come back on my second commission.
You got two letters then, did you?
I got two separate letters, yes. Yeah.
What did you have to do then?
Report? I was told to report to the 14th Northumberland Fusiliers at Berkhamsted in Cheshire, forthwith.
They weren't at Fenham Barracks then, at that time?
No, that was the depot of the Northumberland Fusiliers, Newcastle on Tyne.
How did you get to Berkhamsted?
I sent a railway warrant, and I had to, first of all, I had to equip myself with a uniform, which I did, and certain items of military clothing and equipment.
Can you remember what they were now?
Yes, I was supposed to buy myself field glasses, sword, and the usual khaki jackets and Sam Brown belt, and a pistol, khaki boots, and brown boots, and khaki putties, and breeches to suit with the normal service cap. So I was fully equipped.
Did you get a grant or an allowance to help pay for that?
I got a grant. I think it was very small, I think £25, something like that.
Did that cover the cost of these items?
It did, oddly enough, most of them. Not the expensive things like field glasses and a revolver. I got those later. But Did they try
and sell you anything else? Because sometimes... Did they try and sell you items of kit that they told you might be essential or were not essential, the suppliers? Or did they just give you the basic kit?
No, they didn't try and push off anything I didn't want. I'm sure that somehow or other I acquired what's called a Wolseley valise, in other words, a canvas roll-up. And I had to take my own blankets. So they had the sleeping gear equipped and a great coat. The cost, I didn't pay my tailor. I had all this on tick. But otherwise, I couldn't have lived. I had to live off the uniform allowance when I joined the regiment and we were in camp because the pay didn't cover the cost of messing. And I had no private means. So I had to live off the uniform allowance until the government realised that they were dealing with impecunious people for once in their lives and raised the pay, and the messing was dropped, and so I was able to make both ends meet.
Well, I'll ask you again about that messing when we come to talk about the condition. What was your reception when you first joined the unit at Berkhamsted?
Do you mean, was it hostile or...?
Well, no, what did they do to make you welcome or unwelcome? How did they slot you into the battalion?
It was a very peculiar way of joining a battalion. I arrived in Berkhamsted and reported to somebody, some military person there at the railway station, I think, railway transport officer, who at least... had my name and a billet, and I was directed to a billet where I spent the night. And the next morning I got up and on my instructions replaced, I had to report to her, which is a church square somewhere in the middle of Berkhamsted. And when I arrived there, I met a, I think it was the adjutant of the battalion, who said, "Oh, you're in charge of C Company." I said, "Where is it?" He said, "Oh, there it is, on the right." And there on the right were 250 men in very worn out civilian clothing, and one or two elderly looking chaps with metal ribbons on their breasts standing about in front of them. And so I walked up to one of them, stood to attention smartly, and said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Where is the company commander?" And he said, "There isn't a company commander yet." I said, "Who is commanding the company at the moment?" And he said, "I am." I said, "Well, what are you?" He said, "I'm Corporal Robbins. I was in the South African War. And these are my medals." He said, "Will you please take over the company, sir?" And left me standing. So I didn't see anybody else. I had no idea how to dismiss the company or what I had to do, but eventually I saw all the other companies dismissing, and so I employed the traditional, unconsciously employed the traditional usage in the army, which was carry on, Sergeant Major. And so I told this chap, "Well, let me see how they march. Will you carry on and dismiss?" "Oh, yes, sir." So, delighted to do it, he promptly marched the company off and dismissed them. And I drew a deep breath of relief, having got that one over, and went and I think the men found the colonel somewhere or other, and he, all his instructions were, "Well, in the same place tomorrow." So thereupon I went down to W.H. Smith and Company, who had a bookstore at the station, and where I could buy a copy of the Manual of Military Training. And I got this out, and fortunately it's very explicit. It gave all the drill movements from the beginning to the end. So I had a box of matches, put them out on the dining room table to represent sections and platoons and companies, and I got one or two movements off by heart. So the next morning I had the first couple of movements off by heart, and so I practiced those a few times, and they went off all right. And the next day after that I got a couple more movements off. And by the end of the week I was turning the company inside out, back to front, marching sideways and every way, and delighted with myself. I don't think the troops ever got down to a moment that I was one jump ahead of them the whole time. Then various officers began to roll in gradually, and we got a company commander and so forth.
So you, during this initial period, you weren't given any help at all in the words of command and the arts of command?
No. Absolutely none.
Not even any advice or tips from fellow officers?
No, in fact, it fell to my lot to hand out tips and advice for newcomers themselves. And I got quite uppish about, you know, being the head man, as it were, and quite disappointed when the captain arrived and took over the company. But the colonel never got the officers together and said, "Well, gentlemen, I'd like to understand this, and in future we should do so and so, and on such occasions, such and such." He merely left it to find out for ourselves. Went by a negative process.
Was he the only experienced officer, the regular, the colonel?
No, there were one or two one or two regulars, and one or two from all sorts of peculiar places. One was a captain in the St. Lucia Volunteers. Others came from Canada, Mexico, all parts of the earth. The strangest collection of people. Anybody with a smattering of military training. And eventually we managed to get together all right. And what to our salvation was the arrival of a few non-commissioned officers from regular units in India. They were corporals of good standing and so on, and were sent home and promoted to company sergeant major. And they, of course, knew their stuff.